Amen. Okay, today we are going to be finishing up the history section, and we're going to move into the sociological section of Roman society that we will finish up tomorrow discussing that. Right now, we have talked about the first triumvirate that eventually ended with Julius Caesar in power as the first imperator that ultimately led to his death because he was pretty careless with the way in which he furthered himself. Then we moved into the rise of the second triumvirate that initially started off between a war seizing the throne between Mark Antony and Octavian that eventually led to the development of the second triumvirate with Lepidus added in there as well. Eventually that was destroyed with the exile of Lepidus, and he ends up dying in 12 BC. Ultimately you see Mark Antony and Octavian fighting over the Roman world, splitting it in half. Mark Antony is eventually destroyed in the Battle of Actium, although he doesn't commit suicide until about 9 months later or so in Alexandria, along with Cleopatra, and Octavian becomes the official ruler. We also talked about last class how he administratively was just as much of a genius as he was militaristically. He did several different things that perpetuated and preserved his power that his dad, or adopted dad, didn't exactly do well. One of the things was that he hides his increasing power behind Republican tradition. Another thing he does is he defers overt accolades. Oh, I'm not God, I'm just the son of a God. Okay. And number three, the ones he does accept, he accepts begrudgingly and shrewdly. And we ended last class talking about one of the things that ends up replacing his name Octavian is Augustus. Augustus is an honorific title that means his reverence or his worship. It's the Greek word sebastos. And it has divine undertones, but it's not overtly divine. It's not like calling him a god. It's just close. At the same time, it also is not like calling him a dictator, but it's close because he is the sovereign ruler over everybody known as his reverence or his worship. Any questions about that so far? Before we move on and finish up Augustus, we can call him Augustus now, because it's past 27 BC. All right. A couple of different things that Augustus does, a couple of different advantages, I guess I should say, that Augustus has at his disposal, that he uses, that he leverages in order to secure his power and perpetuate his legacy. The two advantages are this. Number one, his victory over Mark Antony is leveraged huge to gain people's support and allegiance to him. And the reason why is because we're coming out of a period of over 100 years of civil war. Going back to Tiberius Gracchus, all the way down to Drusus, down to, what's the third guy, Sulla? You've been having these civil wars, people trying to seize the throne for a while. The second triumvirate comes about, and it starts off as a civil war between Mark Antony and Octavian. And eventually, when finally Octavian deals the death blow to Mark Antony, he essentially stops all civil war. Something we'll talk about in a minute that they refer to as the Pax Augustus. But we'll get to that in a minute. But ultimately, his ending of civil war in Rome was something that he really held on to and leveraged and that people were grateful for. They were really grateful. It's one of the reasons why Abraham Lincoln is so iconic. He stopped the civil war that almost destroyed the entire I almost said the word empire. Nation. And you can determine what you think about the word nation or empire in that context. Number two, Augustus also leverages his master propaganda. He just was a brilliant propagandist. He just knew how to really make his name well known. His presence always present, and yet not ascending to the, or not falling into the same pitfalls that his father had. He was a master propagandist. He utilizes coins, which his dad kind of started. Remember in 44 BC when the very first face of a living person appears on one of the coins? Well, Augustus will take up that particular strategy, but he does it in ways that are much more shrewd. So the two things he leverages as the ending of all civil wars and his PR, his good public relations propaganda machine, coins, architecture, slogans, etc. So these two major elements or these two key areas of leverage lead to these two major accomplishments that preserve and perpetuate the Empire of Rome to its ultimate dominance throughout the first century. And these two developments are this. Number one, this is the time whenever the mantra Pax Romana really becomes in vogue. I've already told you that they refer to it as Pax Augusta. A Pax Augusta. Pax meaning what? Everybody, I'm hoping everybody knows that by this point. Peace. the Pax Augusta, the Peace of Augustus, which is also paralleling, or they'd be used interchangeably with Pax Romana. Because Augustus was the one that brought peace to the Roman Empire. Because until then, 100 years of civil war has now been laid to rest. Therefore, he will leverage this in his propaganda to say, I am the benefactors of the favor of the gods I'm now giving to you. And it has manifested itself in the peace that you're now experiencing. And this peace leads to the second major development. This Pax Romana, Pax Augusta, leads to the expansion of Romanization. He is not just offering peace to the world. He's offering civilization. As a matter of fact, this is around the time period where the word barbarian really becomes in vogue, it really used a lot. And the reason why is barbarians weren't a geographical location, it were people that were uncivilized. And this is pretty interesting. Education was something that the Romans pushed huge whenever they would dominate a place. As soon as they would dominate, for example, let's say some of the Germanic territory up in the northwest, one of the ways that they would develop their ideology or their hegemony was to educate them, to make them civil. Because if they are educated, if they are civil, then they can actually understand the propaganda that Rome's spitting out. But if they're more tribal and aboriginal, then they can't even grasp the dominance that Rome's trying to exert over them with their ideology. Is this making sense? One of the key ways of developing people, of getting people to be a part of your empire, was to educate them in the ways of Rome, to make them civilized. Britain did the same thing when their colonization. One of their main goals was to give them the civilized lifestyle of Britain. Because the more they can teach them that civilized lifestyle, the more that they can then use their imperial ideology to keep them where they want them. Education, then, is not just a tool to make people's lives better. Education, then, can also be used as a political oppressive tool. Because if they don't know the rules of society, they're not going to obey them. And the only way they can know them is if you give them the proper education that can then be used as a foundation to perpetuate your imperial propaganda. Does this make sense? It's a crazy way to think about it, but it is. You can't subject people to imperial dominance if they don't even understand symbols. So what are you going to do? You're going to teach them Greek mythology. You're going to teach them Roman mythology, Roman history. You're going to teach them the way in which cities of Rome are organized, because even the cities, the way they're organized, plays into their imperial propaganda. You're going to do whatever you can to make them civil, so that then they can understand the dominance you're exerting over them. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I was just wondering if there's any evidence that there was a limitation of the knowledge, like they only gave them as much as they needed to know.
They're not going to show all their cards. Basically, they're going to train them in the public transcript.
Okay, just like the basic stuff.
Yeah. The basic.
If you learn too much, then you become self-aware of what is happening to you, and that's what leads to.
Yes and no. It's kind of like if even in modern day empires, you're going to teach them how to act in the public transcript, so that then the deference can happen. Even the more they investigate, you also have inhibitors that are in there as well that you can make sure you keep them within.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, they're not going to bring out their whole hidden transcript and lay it in front of them. They're not going to say, I'm giving you education so that you can be obedient to us. But it's one of the reasons why one of the things that we're doing in Afghanistan and Iraq is trying to educate the people. Because they don't understand democracy. Because it's not because they hate freedom. It's because it's foreign to them. They've not lived that way for 2,000 years. They're communal society. As a result, having a voice or having a vote is nothing that they don't even... We'll even talk about in a bit. If you're an individual that you single yourself out in a communal society, it's actually a threat not just to you, but to the whole society. So one of the things, in order for us to accomplish the goals in Iraq and Afghanistan, we've got to re-educate them. Otherwise, what we are trying to give them, they will never understand. And therefore, we can never have any sort of alliance or dominance over those regions. We can't. Because they don't understand the rules. And if they don't play by the rules, then we can't dominate them with the rules. Or control them. I'm not saying that our whole purpose is... I'm just saying, if I'm thinking imperialistically, that's one of the reasons why you've got to teach them about being an individual. Because one of the problems is they were okay with the dictators. Because to step out of society and say you're wrong is to threaten your whole group. So no one in the group wanted to. No one in the group even saw that as an option. So we've got to teach them about individualism. Otherwise, they're what we are giving them, they won't even know they need. You see the issue? And this is the way. You've got, basically what you're doing is, through the education, is you're teaching them to speak the same language as you, so that then you can put the propaganda in place that you want in order to get the goals that you want. And maybe the goal of, you know, of America is not dominance over that country. Maybe it's just to have a strong ally. Regardless, you still got to re-educate them. And you're going against 2,000 years of living one way, and that's going to take a while. Does that make sense? You got to reappropriate the people so that they know how to live in the public transcript. Because they may not even know you are the sovereign. It's kind of like one of the things that I fall into. It's why I've been carded on campus more than once by our security guards. Is because I don't fit the public transcript. And so I've got to show my card to them and have them broaden their definition. It's the same concept. You walk into the room, and it, just because you wear a military fatigue, if you're in an Aboriginal place, they're going, that doesn't mean anything to me. So you got to teach them what these medals stand for and what this stands for and what the colors on the flags mean. Why? Because the more you teach them, the more they understand. All of a sudden, then you begin to grow. You begin to become bigger. And then fear might set in, and they may actually understand they need to be bowing to you. But if you don't teach them, they will never know that that's the reaction that they need to be doing. Does that make sense? So education is a political tool to perpetuate propaganda. Not all the time. I'm not saying that there's always a subversive element of education. But what I'm saying is, don't be naive. There is an element of that. Yes?
What does education look like? Instead of schoolhouses?
One of the first things they would do, and this is brilliant, is they go in and they build a gymnasium. Why? Why? What happens in gymnasiums?
Entertainment.
Ooh, I like that. That's fun. That's pretty entertaining. Huh. And this is the way the Roman life's like. Oh, that's pretty cool. Entices them. It seduces them. First thing you want to do to re-educate people is to get them to want your life more than they want the one they've had. First step. Then they're going to go, what else is Rome like? Oh, well, also Rome's like this, and Rome's like this, Rome's like this. And look at all the roads that Rome can develop. We'll beautify your whole city. One of the key things that Roman soldiers were even trained in was the building of structures. They'd go in, they would wipe out an entire city. And then as soon as the people subjected themselves, they start rebuilding it for them. Why? Because if you belong to Rome, you get the best life you could possibly dream of. Oh. Okay, well then why would I want to fight against that? Exactly, why would you want to fight against that? See how it works? Pretty smart. Okay, let's keep going. That's Romanization. That's the second thing. And his Romanization was very effective. This plays out into the Roman heritage, Roman myths, even the language. One of the best things Alexander the Great did for the Roman Empire was give him a universal language. Nevertheless, Romans spoke Latin, and there's somewhat of a latent animosity towards Greek. Amongst the educators, you would have books that were both Latin and Greek to show that you could read both. And yet you would never speak Latin or never speak Greek in public because that was the language of the barbarians. Pretty interesting. And again, that actually switches from time period to time period, even emperor to emperor. Some emperors didn't have as big of a problem with speaking Greek in public. Some of them just felt it was below them. Ultimately, though, the purpose was this. Romanization's purpose was to unify such a diverse empire. And that's one of the key reasons why Augustus succeeded. Augustus was a success because he unified the empire underneath Romanization. Therefore, it is... Now, this is... See, now, all of this, you're still sometimes wondering, like, how does this impact the New Testament? If you have a message that is counter to Rome, or that is claiming the same things as Rome, then it starts to unravel all the Romanization. And if you unravel their ideology, you unravel their power. And if you unravel their power, that's a subversive threat. So this is making sense? They come along and they look at the myths, and what if they reappropriate the myths and make them actually, instead of the way in which they gain dominance, it's the way in which they're destroyed. You've just deconstructed something that's the very fabric of their power. As a result, Rome's going to have to deal with that eventually. The unity of Rome is predicated on people buying into the public transcript, both religiously, politically, education, etc. Okay? And Augustus accomplished that in significant fashion. Okay, now we're into the first century. I want to hear from you guys about the different emperors that you have studied for your particular book. What were some significant stories or developments, or maybe some parallels that you've seen so far, or maybe some other things you had questions about with your particular emperor? I told you we were going to do this, right? Okay, good. They're that boring, huh?
Nero was a drab. There's nothing really to talk about with him. Claudius, what a bum.
What do you mean? If you agree with that, extrapolate. That's the whole purpose of this moment.
I mean, he got thrust into office by a game of hide and go seek.
Explain that, yeah.
He was hiding because Caligula was killed and his whole family, and Claudius was his uncle, so he was hiding, and some praetorian guard found him and took him down to their camp and said, "You're emperor," and all the Senate were upset, and so he's like, I'll pay you guys off to you and the emperor, and he fined him.
Yeah.
Well, and he was a loser. He was gross, he drooled all over himself, mm-hmm. One of the books said. And then he had a limp, and no one believed in him at all, not even his own family. His mom, his grandmother, and his sister, they were all like, good luck with that one. He's the emperor? Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
Ever
seen
Arrested Development?
Yeah.
It reminds me of Buster.
You know,
like,
Claudius is the ancient Buster.
Not really capable.
See, it'd be interesting then to see if there's even any some of the things that would agree with that persona in the New Testament documents. It'd be interesting to see what if there's some. If that is part of the hidden public transcript, notice I conflated those two terms. How does that play out? Sometimes the perception of the emperor is more important than the history of the emperor. Because that's a lot of times will be developing into your point of conversation for the people that are down below. If this guy's known as an absolute loser, even by his own family, how much respect is... And yet, what did he do politically? He actually did a lot of good for the Jews. And against the Jews. What a decade does. For in 41, he comes in and says, no, what Caligula did with the statue being erected inside of the temple is not going to happen. Because that's dumb. And then 49, what does he probably do? Kicks them all out of Rome because they're just a bunch of troublemakers. Yeah?
The Romans coming off of Claudius a little bit.
Yeah?
And then even like Galatians, my book, there's a lot of adoption. Claudius wasn't adopted by anybody.
Yeah.
He was refused adopted by Augustus and Caligula and a couple others too, so part of it.
And if there are some Jewish, and let's just say, like inside of Romans, if there is some tension that's occurring inside of the church, like some people argue, it could make some sense sociologically. If Claudius kicks him out in 49, and all that is left then is these, you know, Christians, but they're not Jewish-based, whenever the Christians are allowed to come back to Rome at the beginning of Nero's reign, you might have like, hey, it's been 5 or 6 years, and this my old church now looks really different. And have you experienced that just going back home from college? You go home and you're like, dude, my church is not even, it says my home church. It just doesn't feel like my home church. What if that could be happening inside of the church, inside of Romans? I mean, they're, what's happening in the Roman world does affect what's happening with the Christians. What else? Claudius, the buster of the ancient world.
I think of Claudius, so, it was interesting to me because you get to looking at what he did as an emperor. I mean, he was fairly successful.
Uh-huh.
He did some pretty good public works. He expanded the kingdom. And within all of this, he does pretty well. But considering his hand within the courts with the Senate, most of our historians were also senators, so mm-hmm. It's no surprise that they reflect him in this negative light. So it's just kind of interesting how
absolutely
history is written by those who are going to kind of reflect what affects them directly.
Yeah, and you bring up another great point. Even our Roman historical documents, you've got to be asking what is their interaction or agenda with the person they're writing about, and does that cloud some of the things they describe him as? I mean, it's like every time, you know, Suetonius in particular. I mean, the way he's going to be interacting with some of the ones that, like you said, were not fans of the Senate, whenever he does give them credit, you really need to pay attention to those details. Because that means you can't deny this, even though I'd like to deny it all. Which is one of the reasons why it leads a guy named Leonard Thompson to suggest that Domitian actually was just a nice guy. He just got a bad rap by all the senators writing that didn't like him. That's overstating it. But he's got an element of truth that's right there. Even the historical documents we have of Rome have a hidden transcript. We can't act like they're the objective ones, and it's just our Bibles that have hidden transcripts inside of them. Yeah, as a matter of fact, wasn't Claudius, he was deified. That should say something about the way ultimately Rome looked at him, because they didn't deify every one of them. It's not like they had to. They voted on it after he died. But you're also dealing with an honor issue. If your emperor has a limp, he's blemished. That's not going to gain you very much respect from barbarians. It's one of the reasons why, whether you like it or not, sorry, even in the ancient world, some people believe that women as the top president of a country is a problem because other countries won't respect her. You see, I mean, so him having a limp could be negative just from the barbarians. Who's going to respect the Roman Empire whenever their emperor is a gimp? So even the reflection on that might be, he brought us great shame even though he advanced us politically. Because who wants a blemished lamb as the one that's reigning everything? Okay, enough of Claudius. Nero, how is that fantastic, wonderful friend? What do we know about him? What's that? Best guy in history? Defend that one. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, something I thought was interesting was that he at least tried to present himself well at the beginning. And, like, I even read somewhere that it was, like, said later as, like, the golden age of Nero or something. And so I'm honestly just kind of curious what... I mean, one... Like, he killed his mother. Mm-hmm. Apparently that was kind of the beginning of...
The end.
Like, yeah, terrible depravity for him.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if he was just faking it and trying, you know, he was giving gifts to people and trying to, like, legitimate.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
For people, so...
Yeah, and you know what? Suetonius seems to be struggling with the same thing. Mm-hmm. What is Suetonius' argument, though? What does he say? He does come to a conclusion about it. Yeah.
He didn't quite have his own opinion.
He's 17, 18 years old. Basically, Suetonius says his mom and Seneca are probably the ones running the empire. Say it again.
The guy's name starts with Brutus.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, but then also, what Suetonius ultimately argues is that he was bad from the beginning. He just was able to cover it up by these other people doing it. Suetonius doesn't say that anything really shifted. He's always been that way. Why? Because that's a Roman belief. You are who you are is who you are. Period. If it comes out later that you're really bad, you were bad all the way from the beginning. Therefore, we need to go back and look at how you grew up to show where you were bad, where the signs were we were just overlooking. If you were good all the way throughout your life, then we need to go back. Even as a baby, we should prove that you were good. Doesn't that say something about Luke, I think? You see, who you are is who you are. Therefore, whenever Nero, and Domitian turns out bad at the end, what they do is they go and look through it throughout all of his life. Bam, there's the parts where he's bad. And there. We just overlooked it. He masked it really well. Yeah?
I kind of wasn't actually that surprised after reading through, like, the childhood of Nero that he did kill his mom. Because, like, she wasn't there in his early life. She was kicked out of society. So mm-hmm. He's being raised by his aunt in poverty. And so he is going to have...
Absolutely. Well, and I believe, I don't know if it's Suetonius or Tacitus, though, it even says that after he killed his mom, that's whenever the hauntings inside the palace started happening for Nero, where he felt like she was always around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Everything he wanted, he got, and the impulsiveness, I think, even could come into play with his mother. And, you know, number one, he lusted for his mother. I mean, read somewhere that he had his mother.
It's possible that there was an intimate relationship.
And then when things started turning bad, his mother started getting upset that she didn't have as much control.
Well, and it may even lead to, how did he get power to begin with?
His mom told him he did kill.
More than likely, his mom was in on the killing of Claudius. And if she's upset that she's not getting the power that she wants, what can Nero possibly be thinking? It's either me or her. I mean, you start to piece together kind of what's happening here just based off of the way in which they lived. But man, him killing his mom was a major PR blunder. As a matter of fact, I don't have it in my notes, but there's an example in the back of my chapter on Revelation 13 in the book, in my book on the Mark of the Beast. There's a footnote where it shows that numbers were used to make fun of Nero killing his mom. I believe it's number 327, where if you take the number 327 and then add up the line about Nero killing his mom, that adds up to 327. And they're making fun of the fact that this guy that's leading all of us had committed matricide. That's a major shaming mark on the whole society. The killer of the killer of his mother is now ruling us. Yeah.
Well, I think you have to, because, like you said, that when someone's hurting, there's always past things, and so he was all of a sudden bad once he killed his mom. I don't think it's true because there's past instances, and you also have to look at the psychological aspect of his mind, the fact that his mom raised him, not raised him, she wasn't there, but that she killed Claudius, and there's always violence or something within his lifetime that grew him to a point to where now it's my turn.
Absolutely. You're exactly right. Definitely. Matter of fact, I mean, violence was their society. Even the definition of peace doesn't come unless it comes through violence. What he inherits is a violent society. He inherits a violent mother, that the way in which you get power and secure power is through violence. Period. Therefore, if he starts losing power, how is he going to respond? Killing her, killing Christians, killing whoever he needs to. Doesn't matter, whoever he needs to. Yeah?
Kind of like what you said, some people kind of try and make it seem like he was good, and then on impulse he killed his mom, and it was all downhill, but did he try to kill her four times or something?
Yeah, there was definitely rumors of that. Fourth time's a charm, I guess. No, definitely not impulsive. No, I would agree with that. He was consistently an embarrassment, though. For example, he loved the theater. And the theater comes out of which empire primarily? Greek. It is not appropriate for a Roman emperor to be one that is performing in theatrical things. Matter of fact, Nero does this. You want to know why people really hated Nero? Because he goes to a theater contest in Greece, I believe. He goes to this theatrical contest, and he wins, obviously, because who's going to have the emperor lose? You know? He goes and he wins, and he comes back with all these awards, and what does he do? He gives himself a triumph because of his conquering of the theatrical world. That is mocking one of the key fibers of Roman society. You don't do a triumph for a theatrical victory. You do it for military victory. And what have you done lately, Nero? He was a laughingstock. I will say, I don't believe, like you said, I don't believe it all of a sudden he clicked and he shifted. Although there is evidence that he probably did also suffer from syphilis, which does eventually do something to the mind. And whenever he got rid of Seneca, that's whenever he continues to ascend into his depths of despair. So you can see things precipitating that leads to the point where he goes nuts. Ultimately, though, this was a guy that was a major... That's why there's two emperors in the first century that end up... it's called Damnatio Memoriae. After they are dead, what the empire decides to do instead of deify them was to erase their memory from the annals. So all their statues, matter of fact, finding a Domitian statue is huge because they were all supposed to be destroyed whenever he died. Matter of fact, you can even see in Ephesus when you're walking down the street, you have this big inscription, it's talking about the emperor, and then all of a sudden you see this whole line that's been chiseled out. It's because more than likely that was probably Domitian's name in Ephesus that was chiseled out because his memory was supposed to be erased. And Nero was one of the other people that had his memory erased.
He was that big of a, not just because of his killing, because of the way and what he did to the honor of Rome. Yes?
A lot of people think that his inclination towards evil deeds starts with his mother and all the things, but they don't remember that he killed his half-brother, who was in contention to the throne before, and some people were trying to elevate to move quickly, him out of the throne in 55. But it makes sense that some psychological problem would have occurred because the paranoia sets in when his mother starts accusing him of things, and then he tries to take out his mother, but later, the latter part of his life is very drenched in paranoia. Who's coming to get me now? He starts executing people that can't even be close to, contending against his throne.
Absolutely.
Or accusing him of anything, and it gets really bad, and then eventually,
he's forced to commit suicide himself. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, and that actually is the plight of several emperors. Domitian, same thing happens. He has one of his key generals that was closest to him basically subvert him, turn his back on him in 89. And then Domitian snapped. His paranoia just exploded in around 89 to 91. And the reason why is because we have one of the closest people to you betray you. Then you realize you're vulnerable at all moments. Matter of fact, Domitian, and I'm talking about Domitian because we need to talk about him some too, but we don't have time to. But I will tell you this story. This is interesting. After he snaps in around 90, 91, there's something called the Black Festival, the Black Feast that Domitian throws. And what happens is he invites after this rejection, this rebellion, this traitor. He invites all the senators to come to this feast. And so they all come and they get there and everything's dressed in black. Everything's in black. And they walk in and each one of their place settings is basically kind of like a tombstone with their name chiseled in it. And he has them all sit down and he starts serving them, but he won't eat. He just sits. And then obviously they're all like, I don't want to eat. And he goes, no, go ahead, eat up. And they're thinking, he's going to poison all of us. We're going to die. They eat everything. Every once in a while, he'd randomly do something that kind of shocked them. They were just freaked out. I was going to say fritzed. Sorry. They were just fritzed out, just freaked out. Well, he then at the very end of the feast happens, and he sends them home. But then he makes them take their tombstone. No, he doesn't. They leave it. That's right. They leave it. So they go home, and they're all kind of like, what is going on? They get home, and all of a sudden, a knock on their door happens. A servant comes, and he hands them the tombstone. And then he just leaves. And the whole point, and nothing, he never kills any of them. But the whole point was, every one of you is vulnerable now. My closest guy traitor is a traitor to me. Every one of you are in trouble now. Any of you cross me, you'll use that tombstone. Because I'll send you there. Domitian became paranoid, and he took that paranoia and incited fear into everyone around him so that they knew the public transcript. And if there was any hidden transcripts, it was going to be rooted out by him. Yeah?
Where can I find that story?
Say it again?
Where can I find that story?
I believe it's at the beginning of Suetonius. He refers to it, but I think it was also picked up by maybe Dio Cassius. I can get the exact details of it if you email me. It would have been anywhere from 89 to 91. Are you talking about the Black Fest? The Black Feast? Yes, 89 to 91.
Do you think that has anything to do maybe with John talking about giving you a new name on a white stone?
Possibly. Possibly. Also, we know the new name on a white stone also is attached to citizenship registries. But it's possible. Definitely. Yeah?
You have to go back to Claudius, but just kind of...
Yeah, that's fine.
The Nero discussion about going back to finding all the bad things. Because Claudius died in kind of a shameful way, being poisoned by his wife, was a gimp and fool and all kinds of things. And his start was a great... especially Dio Cassius, a little bit of Suetonius talks about how his wives and freedmen were really the ones ruling. Because he did good things, that was basically... That was the behind-the-scenes people working with it, really.
Yeah.
Do you think that's as true as much as it is just trying to go back and see, okay, he did this good thing, but maybe that was just his, it wasn't really him.
Yeah, it depends on how you kind of revise history. We do this in modern-day times, too, as a way of kind of making fun of the person. We're like, yeah, right, if we elect Bill Clinton, it's actually Hillary that's our president. People do the same thing. Whether or not that's true or not, it's really inconsequential. It's the perspective that's getting across. So if there was anything good, yeah, they attribute it to somebody else because they're not going to give this anybody anything any good because he's shameful to us. Does that make sense? It's always the way in which subjects react to the people that are over them.
But they kind of gave both sides. Like, if you did anything bad, it was just the white agreement. If you did anything good, it was the white agreement, too. Like,
yeah.
So, I mean, basically, he's inconsequential his whole
brain. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's the main point. That'd be the main point that he'd be trying to get across. This guy's a no-name. Anything else? I know we have Galba, Otho, Vitellius, Vespasian. Yeah?
I just thought it was interesting on Nero that he did like so much that even in his theatrical stuff that he would lock people in with him, people couldn't leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it was Tony's talk about how women would even sometimes give birth because...
Yeah, inside of the theatrical events. Yeah, 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 yeah. He was a paranoid egomaniac. Anything else you guys want to bring up before we dive into Roman society? We've got 5 minutes, I think. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, last thing on Claudius. One thing I thought was interesting that you mentioned before, but that it seems I went back and read some things that there is a hidden transcript that kept on coming out of poking fun of him with the. When he'd fall asleep at feasts, or when he'd fall asleep and snoring with his mouth open after every meal, people would throw stuff at him, or a feather would stick down his throat and make him throw up. I mean, it's
yeah.
I mean, it seemed like even the people knew that there was a respect this guy, but when no one's looking, we're gonna throw olives at him or whatever.
Absolutely, absolutely, and it manifests itself in our society as well, same ways. You totally can't say anything completely. Derisive of the president, but you can poke fun at him, well, this guy's a moron. Yeah, he may have made it through Harvard, but he just barely made it through with D's. Ha ha. It's just different ways, yeah, of bringing out the hidden transcript at different times, without totally getting persecuted for it. And in that time, you're keeping your distance by the fact that he fell asleep.
Just piggybacking on that, the transition between. Claudius and Nero, in Tacitus' account, there's a part where someone's suggesting what they should name Nero upon his birth, to Agrippina, and someone suggests that we name him Claudius, and she laughs and adamantly says, "No, that's not funny." because they were jokingly doing it. Why would we just name him Claudius?
Yeah.
It's just he was the kind of the butt of the joke.
I will tell you this, the more you study this empire studies hidden transcript up, you see it pop up everywhere. I mean, everywhere. Even in, even during chapel time, something will happen and you're going, oh, there's an incongruency that's happening with what's on stage and what's actually reality. Yeah, it happens all the time. Yeah, Stephanie.
Claudius didn't really know that everyone thought he was dumb, right?
Does...
Because all through, every thing that he does is very I'm Claudius. And, everybody's okay, that sounds good,
Maybe, but it's kind of one of the things, was George Bush naive of all the jokes that are made about his intelligence? He wasn't naive about it, but he would never say, "You guys are right." As a matter of fact, if I were him, I'd look back and be like, "You guys voted me in, what does that make you?" But he would never do that. Why? Because if he would ever stoop down to that, then he's actually lowering his honor and dealing with something that's not dignified to even be in his presence. So therefore, if he ever reacts to the public or to the hidden transcripts, unless he can absolutely destroy it. But if he ever reacts to it, it actually would lower him down to the level that people thought he was to begin with. So one of the best things you can do is to act as if it doesn't exist. Yeah.
But the opposite of that happens in Suetonius when he comes out and says, "I wasn't stupid when I was a kid. I was just pretending so that nobody would think I'm a threat. But throwing it, here I am because it worked."
Yeah.
He believes that. So he does say, he does acknowledge the...
He's not, and that's why I would say he's not unaware.
Right.
It's just that he doesn't submit to it. He's not unaware. He's going to act the part. Because if he acts dumb... then ultimately it'll have ramifications on him that he'll be removed from the throne anyway. And maybe he did. Maybe the whole time he was in the public transcript, using his own hidden transcript in order to secure what he ultimately wanted, and that was the throne. Maybe. We still have 2 minutes, and I'm going to use them, so I'm just letting you know. Yeah?
One of the things that struck me about Domitian is that he seemed tremendously insecure about everything. always living under the shadow of his dad and his brother, and mm-hmm. never really having any military accomplishments. So it seems like he was always like compensating for that by like giving him a bunch of elaborate stuff in the Colosseums and the games and stuff, and then making them deify him in writing all the time, and
yeah,
like killing people for just joking about him or anything like that.
And we've talked about that somewhat already, but you're exactly right. Domitian especially, and I think Nero too, the most insecure ones usually are the most vicious. They've got to gain honor in some way. And if you haven't done it with your resume, then you will enforce your position on people in order to make it... That's like one of the things... and this will happen in your churches. This happens even as a professor, where somebody will challenge you in a way that is completely unacceptable. It's completely inappropriate. But it's your insecurity a lot of times that lashes back out at the person. But if you're secure with who you are, you'll be able to handle a lot of people talking about you negatively. Am I being faithful? Have I put the time in? All of a sudden now, the different hidden transcripts that are being used against you, you don't even need to address. There's no point. But you think there won't be hidden transcripts being said about you whenever you're teaching or preaching somewhere? You're sorely mistaken. But if you're insecure about your faithfulness or about who you are, then a lot of times you'll react in a very poor manner. Wisdom comes with knowing who you are, especially in light of God, and being comfortable in that. So whenever somebody brings up something that is not who I am, a lot of times I don't even feel the need to even address it. And the reason why is because I know who I am. I know who I belong to, and I know where my identity resides. But somebody like a Domitian or a Nero, they're going to be very insecure because they have a reason to be insecure. Because they have not done the military exploitations that other people have done. They have to bankrupt the empire. Matter of fact, one of the very first things that Domitian does is he ups the value of the denarius by 4 times, bankrupting the empire. And he refused to lower the value of it, even whenever the whole empire was going under. He refused. Why? Because he was establishing, under my reign, we are luxuriously extravagant, because we can be. And to lower the value that he had upped is a shameful thing on him. He never would. He's overcompensating because he did have a reason. He does have a reason to be insecure. Because he's got nothing to offer. And that plays itself out everywhere. We're gonna accomplish. Let me say this: whatever we do not accomplish on Roman society will not be on the oral exam. So don't freak out. Okay? And you're going, well, where are we gonna get that part? We're gonna talk about it. We have the rest of the semester to be discussing things, and it may come out at different places and at different times than one lecture. You'll get the information though, okay? So whatever we don't accomplish tomorrow will not be on the oral exam. Cool? Okay. Love you. See you tomorrow.